now across North Carolina. Carolina Newsmakers, providing in-depth and candid interviews with North Carolina's government, political, education, and business leaders. Here's your host, Don Curtis.
Welcome to Carolina Newsmakers. I'm Don Curtis, and our guest this week, a very timely one I might add, is John Davis. And John, of course, is known as the predictor of all predictors in North Carolina. He is a political analyst and president of John Davis Consulting, and has spent his entire life guessing what the public is going to do in advance, and sometimes that comes with some amount of peril, John.
Yes, it does.
We were talking before the program came. I was giving you my two cents worth, and I said the public are incurable pessimists, and the politicians are incurable optimists. And so, when the politicians promise more than they can do, the public comes back and says, "You didn't do it."
That's exactly right. We certainly saw that this week in Massachusetts.
What an interesting election, because, of course, I think there were two things that sort of caught my eye there. One is the fact, of course, that is basically a very liberal state. But the high number of registered unaffiliates there, I think it was over 50%,
right,
which means that there is a lot, even in that state, of folks who are not happy with any particular political party.
Right. And I think you see that in North Carolina. We have about 21-22% right now of our registered voters are unaffiliated. 10 years ago, it was less than 5%.
Yeah, we called them independents those days.
That's right. So, but what I think was really fascinating is that the unaffiliated voters in Massachusetts, New Jersey, and Virginia this year flipped from about 60-40 Obama to 60-40 for Republicans. So very clearly, there's a lot of concern throughout the country about the direction that Obama is leading us, and voters are beginning to rise up and make a statement about that, and you're certainly seeing it this year.
Well, you know, a couple of things. Sweeping change is always hard for anyone to accept. And I think that, at first it sounds pretty good and you say, oh, that's great. We need health reform. And, I guess it's universal that everybody knows we need some health reform. The debate gets to be how and when. But when people begin to read the details and they say, wait a minute, this affects me. I didn't think it was going to affect me. I thought it was going to affect everybody else.
Right. But I think the greater problem is the fact that he promised transparency. And instead, he's doing everything behind closed doors. He says, wait till we get this thing passed and I sign it. Then you're going to find out about it and be surprised at all the good things that are in it. Well, the American public just doesn't want to operate that way.
Yeah.
And what's really bizarre is that he actually said in his speeches in 2008, that the big mistake the Clintons made back in 1993 was that they took their friends behind closed doors and closed the door on health care debate. And he's making that exact same mistake, and the voting public just isn't going to put up with it.
Well, it's of course, and the other interesting thing is that's not the only problem we've got going now. And so you wrap all that dissatisfaction into one package. We have, of course, the economists tell us we're coming out of the Great Recession. But it's not shown up yet, and so people are very dissatisfied with the high rate of unemployment and all that sort of thing. And when you focus on one thing, there's a tendency, I guess, for the public to believe nothing's happening on the other front.
Well, that's exactly right. And even the Democrats today are beginning to say, Pennsylvania's Senator Democrat Bob Casey, saying that making health care more important a priority than jobs is causing Americans to sense that Washington isn't listening. Whatever happens on health care, he said this week, you've got to focus on jobs. So I think once again, that's where the American fear is, the financial stability of the nation and of themselves, and to take attention away from that and focusing on health care, and especially, once again, doing it the way he's doing it, and that's behind closed doors after he promised transparency, promised that he would play that out on C-SPAN. He actually said 8 times in 2008, when it comes to health care debate, that's going to be on C-SPAN, and he did just the opposite. He'd made the same mistake the Clintons made.
Well, I think sooner or later also people realize that health care reform meant realigning who pays and how it pays. Health care is going to cost roughly the same amount. It's just a matter of how it's paid for. There's not going to be any gigantic savings all of a sudden because we've got a health care plan. It doesn't mean that all of a sudden a procedure that costs $1,000 to the hospital is going to cost less. It's just a matter of who pays for it.
That's right. Correcting things that need to be corrected. I think the American public supports a lot of the individual items of concern with regards to health care, but they want to be included in the debate.
Yeah, and then, of course, then you get some social issues like abortion and so forth
right.
beginning to be affected by it, and that brings people who have very strong feelings in those fronts as opponents, and otherwise they might even be in favor of it.
That's right.
So you've got all sorts of concerns. So, John, what do you think the Obama administration ought to do, let's say specifically about health care? Should they drop it and just say we're going to have to regroup, or should they pass what they can? Or what do you think would be politically, I'm just talking about politically now, the best way for the Obama administration to come out of this so that they are not killing the chances of the Democratic Party in the November elections?
Yeah, the first thing Obama is going to have to do is to recognize that he is the problem. If he can't do that, if he continues
to operate. Okay, now how do you mean he's the problem? Because he's pushing one issue?
He's pushing something that the American public has concerns about and doing it in a way that no one appreciates. Once again, promised transparency, promised it would be on C-SPAN. Everything's being done behind closed doors. And he says, when I sign it, you're going to be surprised at how good it is. That's just not the way we operate in this country. So he's hurting the Democratic brand. You're seeing that play out in other states. You saw it in Virginia, New Jersey, Massachusetts. You're going to see it play out in North Carolina. He's hurting the entire Democratic Party brand.
And sooner or later, those who are running for office come out and say, you know, Brock, I like you a lot, but my livelihood and my candidacy is in peril here, and I can't vote with you anymore.
Yeah, that's exactly right, and you're going to see that in mass in the next couple of weeks. Democrats know that he's not handling it right, and I think, once again, if he's willing to accept that he's part of the problem, he's going to be allowed to go back to the drawing board with full support of the Democrats and perhaps even some Republicans and get something passed. I don't think health care is dead by any means. It just has to be done. Once again, do it on C-SPAN.
Well, everyone, as far as I know, knows that some health reform is going to have to happen
right.
because we can't keep pushing it. Somebody pays for all this somewhere, and it's out of kilter, and the system's just not working. But I haven't run into hardly any politicians who are in favor of leaving it exactly like it is.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Well, that's going to be interesting to watch. And now, let me ask you this, because, again, we've got you on the program today because you're looking at everything from, at least in this program, from a political point of view. Can it be resurrected to the point where the Democrats aren't going to get really blasted in November, or is it too late for that?
I don't think it's too late. It's January, and that's a long way to November. So there is a potential that Democrats can get this thing right, turn it around, you know, by late summer and in time for it not to be have a devastating impact on the elections of 2010 in the fall. But
if that happens, who's going to be the architect of that? Who's going to take charge and go up to President Obama and say, okay, we've got a nice situation here in the House and the Senate, and if it's going to stay that way, we've got to do this.
Yeah, I think it's going to have to be the seasoned old-timers that recognize that mistake but just haven't told him that his hubris, his arrogance, his my way or the highway attitude is a problem. People like Jim Hunt, wise, very, very wise. I think Bill Clinton, who went through the same thing back in 1993, turned his administration around, enjoyed the longest period of economic expansion in U.S. history by the time his administration ended. Of course, he had a few other problems, but a lot accomplished as well. Jim Hunt, same thing, saw the handwriting on the wall, saw that we are operating without respect for the priorities of the voters. Let's go around. Let's turn around and get it right. They came out for welfare reform. Remember, it was the Democrats that led the charge on that. Of course, Republicans had a lot to do with it. But the Democrats got the picture. And they came out for health care reform. They came out for doing something about getting tough on crime. We built more prisons under Jim Hunt than we can count. Bill Clinton was talking about more cops on the street. So they got the picture. The question is Obama going to get the picture? He was not elected because he was a liberal. He was elected because he offered hope for change, change in how Washington operates. I think Bill Clinton knows that. Jim Hunt knows that. So those guys can get to him and help him appreciate that he's part of the problem.
John, you've been around the people who work for the presidents in many cases, and also those who work for the governors. This becomes their source of information, and they've actually got a different agenda. And I guess when you hear it every day, I'm talking about his staff, his personal staff, the people that work with him every day. They have a slightly different viewpoint than the elected official, and yet they're his ears. And how much of this problem is that he just keeps hearing that everything's okay, we're going to get this done, and so forth, from his administration staff, not the Senate and the House?
Well, you know, once again, I go back to the top of the chart. I think it's not his staff. I think it's him that is insisting once again on, this is the way we're going to do it. I don't care if everybody's mad about it. We're going to do it this way. We're going to get it done. His staff can't do much about that if he insists on operating that way. His campaign manager back in 2008, a guy named David Plouffe, wrote a book called The Audacity to Win, and he talked about Obama's what he described as his significant self-confidence. He talked about their first meeting, and he was trying to convince Obama back in 2003 when he was going to run his campaign for U.S. Senate in Illinois, he was trying to convince him to allow the campaign professionals to run the campaign. Obama said, I think I can do a better job on any job in this campaign better than the people I hire to do it. That's Barack Obama. Mm-hmm. He thinks he can do a better job with health care reform than anybody else in the country, and he's just going to go in there and get it done, do it his way, do it behind closed doors, and he'll tell you about it when it gets it done. It's not going to work.
Interesting. Well, we're going to continue our conversation about not only the national scene, but also what might happen on the state scene when we return with John Davis here on Carolina Newsmakers.
Are you looking for a way to give back to your community? If so, your local Guardian Ad Litem office needs your help. The North Carolina Guardian Ad Litem program is celebrating its 25th anniversary of being a voice for children who are victims of child abuse and neglect. Volunteer today to become a trained, independent advocate to represent the best interests of abused and neglected children in court proceedings. As a Guardian Ad Litem volunteer, you will also help work toward ensuring that each child is placed in a safe, permanent home, what every child needs. The Guardian Ad Litem program needs volunteers. If you have just a few hours each month to make a difference, please don't wait. Call 1-800-982-4041 or visit ncgal.org. Volunteer for the Guardian Ad Litem program. Be the voice for a child.
I'm sorry, sir, but it appears as though your credit card has been declined.
Did everyone hear that? This person right here, credit card declined. If we can please have an awkward silence.
Whoa, I'm with a date here. Look, so I'm late on a few payments. I'll make it up next month. Promise.
He promises to pay it all back next month. Can we have an aww?
Putting more on your card than you can afford to spend can lead to even bigger problems, like public humiliation. Don't let your credit put you in a bad place. Go to controlyourcredit.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Treasury and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Carolina Newsmakers. Here's your host, Don Curtis.
This is Carolina Newsmakers. Our guest is John Davis, who is a well-known political analyst and president of John Davis Consulting, and he studies politics and political races all the time. And you have a newsletter, John. Let's get a plug in for that so that if people want to subscribe, they can get in touch with you and join your newsletter list.
Well, thank you. It's called John Davis Political Report. It comes out every week. And a lot goes into it. I usually generate 30 pages of work to get it down to 3 pages of the final report. So if you're interested in it, go to
Now, you
John
clearly
Davis
are not
Consulting.
A lawyer, because a lawyer takes 3 pages and turns it into 30 pages.
That's exactly
You take 30
right.
pages and turn it into 3 pages.
That's
so
exactly
you clearly
right.
you're not a lawyer.
So my job is to distill it down to what people have time to read, and 3 pages is still a stretch, but you get that every week. Go to johndavisconsulting.com if you're interested.
johndavisconsulting.com. And we'll, just in case you can't remember that, we'll give that again later on in the program. Well, John, the other thing that is of interest to all North Carolinians is this election cycle that's coming up, because if for no other reason, there seems to be sort of a change in leadership in the Senate, as some of the longtime leaders are beginning to age out and retire out. And then perhaps even more significantly is the fact that we will be electing the folks who are going to be charged with redistricting North Carolina, and that could have a long-term effect on how politics is handled in North Carolina. But let's talk about the first issue, where we have people like David Hoyle, who's been very influential in the state for a long time, not seeking re-election. He comes from – he's a Democrat, but he comes from a Republican county, probably going to lose that seat. So, first of all, what do you see happening in the state Senate in the election? And then secondly, how is this going to impact the way that North Carolina is run?
Well, you know, the Senate, I have always thought the North Carolina Senate Democratic Caucus created the national model for a political war machine. They did everything right, and that's why cycle after cycle they continue to win the close races, hold on to their base, raid Republican turf, and pick off a few Republicans. They are so effective, but I'm thinking now that the disruption in the leadership in the Senate could lead to the first time in many election cycles that they're not as effective in raising money as they've always been, because they've been able to raise money and use that to gain an advantage over Republicans in close races. David Hoyle's last race, he won 51% to 49%.
So it was close to begin with.
He spent $500,000. His opponent spent $81,000. So he outspends his opponent 5-1 and wins by a couple of thousand votes out of 75,000 cast. So that's the way the Democrats have been able to do it. They swamp you with money. So there are at least 8 or 10 races that they won that way. If they're able to maintain that same sort of advantage with money, 3-1, 4-1, in the Senate races, then I think they still have potential to win the close ones. So Republicans can't take it for granted just because Obama's creating a problem with Democratic loyalty, or Governor Easley is likely to complicate the Democratic branding concerns with the likelihood of corruption-related scandal this year. So Democrats are going to have a tough year, but once again, it all comes down to whether Republicans are going to be able to raise the money to outshout them.
Well, we've had a unique blend of styles in the duo that has been so much running the Senate, and that would be Tony Rand, who, of course, has also announced his retirement. In fact, is already retired from the Senate, and of course, Mark Bastnight, and they have been pro-business as Democrats. And that's where a lot of that money has come from. So if they are replaced with more populist-type candidates like Martin Nesmith, can they raise that kind of money?
Well, that's yet to be seen. It's never happened. Mm-hmm. Tony Rand truly was the power behind the throne, and his departure cannot be overestimated as an impact on the ability of the Senate Democrats.
Would you call Tony Rand's retirement the most significant political event of the decade?
I'm not sure of the decade, but certainly of this election cycle.
No.
I mean, he is that significant. I interviewed him once about how they did it. You know, how in the world every 2 years you guys pull off these wins? And he said, "We run it like a business." He said, there's no friendship involved when it comes to political decisions. We run it like a business. He said, we hire the best people we can hire. And if you look at their If you look at their expenditure reports, you're seeing they're having opposition research done in Pennsylvania. They're having a mail come out of Michigan, ads being cut in other states. So they truly have gone throughout the country to hire the best people they can hire and, of course, to raise the money to fund them, and they consistently win.
John, you've always been an advocate that money wins elections, and, of course, you always have all the background information. You know, at one time it was the Republican Party nationally that had all the money. In the last couple of turns, it's been the Democrats that have all the money. What's going to happen on the national scene in the money picture? Will that even out? Will the Republican candidates start getting back to a point where they are, in many cases, have a chance to spend the same amount of dollars?
Well, money flows to power. Get the power, you get the money. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's what we see with Senate Democrats or House Democrats in North Carolina. But right now, the power has shifted, not from Democrats to Republicans, but from Democrats to the people of the country who are angry and are forming these groups like the Tea Party folks and are furious, and they're organizing. And that is where I think the resources are going to shift. And that is going to obviously help Republicans or anybody that's in an anti-establishment position, like in North Carolina. And if those who fund candidates who are interested in being associated with those who have the power, if those people see that Republicans, with the help of an outraged electorate like the Tea Party folks, are about to at least gain parity with Democrats in this state, then they're going to start sending money to Republicans, and that's going to level the playing field. If that happens and it's a lousy year for Democrats, Republicans are going to take over both the state Senate and House.
I had one one office holder tell me that this was about a year and a half ago, that he was dismissing the influence of the Tea Party crowd by saying that they may call themselves the Tea Party crowd, I call them the crackpots. But truly, they have had a great influence.
They really have. And I think a great part of their influence comes from the fact that they've stayed away from a lot of the social issues that tend to divide people, including dividing conservatives among each other or Republicans divided against Republicans. And they focused on economic concerns. And I think that's a big, big deal. If that continues, then that's really going to – and, of course, it looks like that they're choosing to be more supportive of Republicans than Democrats. And if that continues, I think you're going to see a much stronger base of Republican activists. One of the things that Obama was able to do was to create this huge millions of people willing to work for his candidacy in 2008. That hadn't happened since, but it's beginning to happen because of angry voters, but on the Republican side of things.
John, have you done any research with the real core Obama group, or have you seen research done with the folks that really were out there, as you said, going door to door? Is their satisfaction level dwindling, or is it just those middle-of-the-pack folks who ended up being swayed to vote for Obama?
No, very clearly it's waning, except for African-Americans. African-Americans obviously have a very unique reason to continue to support Obama no matter what. First African-American president in U.S. history. That is such a big deal. For African-Americans to see an African-American walk down the stairs of Air Force One in countries around the world and being greeted by heads of state, that's something they've never seen before. To see an African-American first lady be the envy of the fashion world, that's never happened before. So that's a big deal. African Americans aren't budging. Their support for him, Obama, is loyal. On the other end, there are these new voters that this base of Obama supporters were able to register and turn out to vote. New voters who typically don't vote in high percent, young voters 18 to 24, 18 to 30, who typically don't vote in high percent, those are the ones that were counting on Obama to do what he promised, change the way Washington works, continue to offer hope for a better way in America. And that's who he's disappointed. That's who didn't turn out to vote in Virginia and New Jersey and Massachusetts. And it was the independents that were a part of his camp going 2-1 in many cases in many states for Obama in 2008 that are now going 2-1 against Obama and for Republican candidates in 2010. So he truly has disappointed a lot of the folks that he was able to get involved in the politics of 2008.
Well, again, I want to ask the same question. I think I've asked it before, but is there time for this to turn around to where it does not affect the November election?
Absolutely. And a lot can happen, as you know, in a year. This time a year ago when he was sworn in, he was on top of the world. And as you noted earlier, the Tea Partiers were considered kooks. And now their stock is up and his stock is down in just 1 year. So I truly believe that anything can happen between now and Election Day in November. And no one excited about what's happened in Massachusetts this week better take anything for granted. You still have to go back to the fundamentals, recruit the best candidates, make sure they have the resources, that's professionals, and the money that they need to do combat. Because these Democrats, they will regroup in a minute like they did after the devastating defeat in 1994. They will regroup and they will come back and be very, very competitive. So Republicans cannot take anything for granted.
Our guest is John Davis, and we'll be back with more on Carolina Newsmakers right after these messages.
I can help the next customer over here.
Oh, thank you.
Hi. Wow, that's a lot of books. Let's see. How to keep your child safe. Child-proofing your home. Child-proofing your yard. Child-proofing your in-laws' home and yard. Well, I'm guessing you have a little one at home.
Yeah.
Well, it looks like you must take good care of her.
Oh, thank you.
Now, let's see. Parents' Guide to Safe Toys. That's a really good one. Parents' Guide to Safe Foods. Parents' Guide to Safe Safety Products. Parents' Guide to Parenting Guides. Don't throw the baby out with the bathwater and other safety tips.
Of all the things you can read about keeping your child safe, the most important is attached to the back of their car seat. Read the instruction manual and learn to use the latch system. It makes it easier to be sure your child's car seat is installed correctly.
Parents' Guide to Telling Other Parents How to Raise Their Kids.
To learn more, go to safercar.gov. Anchor, tether, latch. The next generation of child safety. A message from the U.S. Department of Transportation and the Ad Council.
I'm not staying home tonight. I'm at school all day. If they want me to do the work, give it to me while I'm at school. This guy has me coming to work 10 hours a day. So what if I didn't finish school? That doesn't mean he can work me like a dog. Hey, man, I need a few bucks. My car's busted and I need some cash. Hello? Hello?
Every decision you make has a benefit or a consequence. Make the right choices today and be ready for the challenges tomorrow. This message is brought to you by the United States Air Force.
Welcome back to Carolina Newsmakers. Here's your host, Don Curtis.
We're back on Carolina Newsmakers. John Davis of John Davis Consulting is our guest. He's a well-known political analyst here in North Carolina. A reminder, this program is a product of stategovernmentradio.com. And if you'd like to hear a repeat of this broadcast or share it with a friend, you can go to stategovernmentradio.com, stategovernmentradio.com, and you can hear it again, share it with someone else. And John, we always warn everybody, we archive all these programs, including the other times that you've been on the program. And so, you know, a year from now, we might come back and play this again and just see how your projections look.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. I've missed them in the past many times. So, but that's the risk I take, and I really enjoy doing it.
Well, you know, I always liked Harry Truman's line about economists. He said he always wanted a one-armed economist because he said he found out economists would say, this is the way it is. But on the other hand.
Right.
And he said, I want a one-armed economist so they don't come out with that on the other hand thing. Well, John, we've talked a lot about what happened this week as far as the election and Massachusetts. Let's focus on North Carolina. We have an election. All of our congressmen, of course, will be up for re-election. We'll have a United States Senate race, and we'll have, of course, all the members of the General Assembly up for re-election. And so let's talk first about the congressional races in North Carolina. Do you see any change in those who are in? And, of course, we're talking about as of right now. Let's assume that things are just sort of popping along like they are. What do you think the outcome will be with regards to North Carolina's congressmen?
Well, there are 13 seats, and all but one are clearly seats that favor either a Democrat or a Republican, and that's just the way they're drawn. So it's going to be very difficult for Republicans to unseat Democrats in those Democrat-friendly seats and vice versa. There's only one Republican seat held by a Democrat, and that's Heath Shuler. Over in the mountains, and he's as conservative as most Republicans.
He's a blue dog Democrat.
Exactly. He's played it just right, and that creates, you know, a strong candidacy on his part, especially during this anti-establishment, anti-Obama era for Democrats. He's a blue dog Democrat. He's likely to be much stronger than others. But I don't see other Democrats except the one swing seat that could
you're talking about Larry Kissel's seat.
Kissel's seat, yeah. Kissel's seat, that's the one swing seat in the state, clearly could go to a Republican. But once again, we don't know who that Republican's going to be. If they go out there and recruit somebody that can't beat Kissel, then they're not going to lose that one.
The of course, we made reference earlier to redistricting. North Carolina currently has the 13 congressional districts. There's a possibility we could gain one at the end of the election, not as likely as maybe it was last time. But if North Carolina gains another seat and we have to redistrict, and the Republicans come in with at least a strong voice in the state Senate and House, could that balance of power be changed significantly? Can you move counties around just a little bit to the point where it changes some of those safe Senate seats?
You absolutely can, and Democrats have become masters of that sort of work. It's called gerrymandering, and they're really good at it. You create an advantage for Democrats by pulling in African-American voters who are the most loyal Democrat constituency. You create and that's for white Democrats. So there's all kind of ways to gain advantage. You gain an advantage by stacking as many Republicans as you can in a district, conceding that district, but you're getting Republicans out of a district that you want to have an advantage in. So you can clearly do it. And if Republicans are at that table where the remapping is done, it's going to have a big impact for the next 10 years.
Now, we, of course, have one district that weaves all the way through North Carolina that is, of course, was primarily set up so that it would ensure African-American congressman. If that district were changed and those voters were put in the districts that they actually are contiguous with, that would give the Democrats a more powerful voice in more districts.
Could be. I doubt that's going to happen, though. There's no thinking that I've seen that's going to suggest that there's going to be an end to drawing majority-minority districts, especially by next year. So that's likely to continue. I think there are about 18 House districts and six or seven Senate districts in North Carolina that are drawn the same way, called majority-minority districts or minority-minority districts. But anyway, there's an advantage to an African-American, and almost all, a couple of exceptions, are held by African-Americans.
Now, John, so far the growth in Hispanic population has had absolutely no effect on politics, and or no real effect on North Carolina politics. When do you think that will end, and when that 8 to 10% of the population will begin to get to be a real factor in North Carolina politics?
Right. You have to watch the registration numbers, and you can go to the State Board of Elections website and follow this. They keep those records that would include new Hispanic registered voters. Hispanic population may be 7-8%, but as a group of registered voters, less than 1%. And that's the problem. You know, until the registration begins to mirror the typical percent of other voters, blocks of voters in registration, then that that influence is going to be minimal. You'll see it first at the city level, city council races, at the county level. Statewide, it's not there yet and not likely to be there for another 10 or 12 years.
I didn't conclude actually all my questions on the House district. So you're what I'm gathering from what you said, and this is a leading question, so you can set me straight if I need to, is you don't see any incumbents in serious trouble in North Carolina, except maybe Larry Kissel.
Well, if the Obama problem continues to fuel outrage against Obama, it will impact Democrats in places where typically they would be safe. So just like in 1994, people like David Price from Chapel Hill was defeated by a Republican. It may happen, but it's a once in a decade event, because as with David Price, he went back and he's won every time since. So out of voter anger, there may be some upsets. But by and large, the districts are drawn to give an advantage to one party or the other, and that's huge.
And I take it from what you're saying, I'm just reading again into some of the comments you're saying, that you believe the Democrats have had their wake-up call now, that they realize how serious this voter dissatisfaction really is.
Absolutely. And once again, you're going to see Democrats bail on the president until he goes back and gets it right. So, and that includes North Carolina Democrats. So they're smart enough to see the political damage from the other states, and they're going to do everything they can to correct that. And remember, it's January. It is a long way, light years away until November.
Now, of course, we have a senatorial race with incumbent Richard Burr, who is, and I'd like to get your take on this, he's an interesting cat in the sense that he is out there, he's working all the time, but he still doesn't ever seem to be a household word. I mean, there are a lot of people who just, when you say United States Senate, they just don't instantly say right off the tip of their tongue, Richard Burr.
Yeah,
they'll say Kay Hagan, and she's only been in two years.
Yeah, but, you know, Kay Hagan at this point was an unknown in the year 2008 when she won, so money is what gets you there.
Yeah.
And what he's doing is holding his money. And it's yet to be seen if that's smart. But right now, he's raising money by the millions. And he will be a household word when it matters the most. Right now, you know, I don't think he would be too concerned about the polls.
Well, he's a very attractive candidate. He's very articulate. He looks good. He is sort of in touch with North Carolina. One of the things I've always admired about him is when he drives to a political event, it's something he drives himself. He doesn't have an entourage with him all the time.
Exactly. And he drives a beat-up old car, you know. And, you know, the Massachusetts candidate Brown found great value in driving that old pickup truck that had 200,000 miles on it. You know, interesting fact I saw yesterday was there are 45,000 people in Massachusetts that drive pickup trucks. So I doubt a single one of them voted for the Democrat.
So so give us your prediction on that race. Is this a lost cause for the Democrats? Is Burr obviously just a walk-in candidate?
Absolutely not. But it's yet to be seen who the Democratic nominee is going to be. This Cal Cunningham is the kind of guy, kind of like Burr, that you just like. Mm-hmm. When you meet him, you say, there's statewide talent right there. So he truly is an extraordinary young man. Lane Marshall, of course, is in the race. There are others in the race that are going to be fighting each other. The Democrat could come out of the primary walking wounded and give Burr a real advantage in the fall, but you really can't call that a race until you see who the nominees are going to be.
On the money side, the money on the Democrats, at least in the primary, is going to be split.
That's right. That's what makes for a real problem for Democrats. And let me say, this is shaping up to be a Republican-friendly year. And, of course, if that happens this fall and it's Republicans that have wind in their sails and the national momentum, then the Burrs are going to go in easily and there will be surprise upsets among Democrats.
We want to get your predictions on how the North Carolina State House and State Senate might end up, and we'll do that when we return here on Carolina Newsmakers, and we'll do that right after this break.
In small towns and big cities, from coast to coast and around the world, Habitat for Humanity volunteers gather with purpose. Hand in hand, they come together. They may be strangers or they may be friends, but they are all builders of hope and homes. Hammers are raised, bricks are laid, dreams take shape, and another family finds shelter in a home they helped build. Through their time and talents, Habitat for Humanity volunteers are helping change lives for the better, and in the process, maybe even changing their own lives as well. Together, we can eliminate substandard housing. Won't you join us? Support the work of Habitat for Humanity in your community or wherever your heart leads you. Now more than ever, please volunteer, get involved, and help build it. Visit us at habitat.org.
When we get old, will you take care of me if I can't get around anymore?
Of course. We'll find a way. Are you going to take care of me if I can't see anymore?
I'll read to you every day.
And if one of us gets Alzheimer's disease, what then?
Call 1-800-437-2423 for a free booklet on caring for your loved ones from Alzheimer's Disease Research. 1-800-437-2423.
Welcome back to Carolina Newsmakers. Here's your host, Don Curtis.
This is Carolina Newsmakers, and this is our last segment with John Davis, who's president of John Davis Consulting, well-known political analyst here in the state of North Carolina. And again, we want to give that web address of John Davis so that if you want to subscribe to his newsletter, it's johndavisconsulting.com, johndavisconsulting.com.
That's correct.
Or some people might even say it's johndavisinsulting.com. It depends on whether John
is— Just don't type that in your web browser. You won't get anywhere.
Yes, johndavisconsulting.com. John, this is a shorter session, a shorter segment here of our program. We've talked about all sorts of things we have not talked about, except making broad reference to it. The State House and State Senate races, because the Republicans for the first time in a long time are beginning to talk about maybe taking control of the State Senate, or certainly getting real close to that that control factor. What's your view?
Well, the State Senate certainly is shaping up to be a real opportunity for Republicans, primarily because of the number of retirements. Six Democrats have retired in a caucus of 30. Incumbents are the easiest to elect, so having to go back to the drawing board and start over with new candidates in those districts is just going to cost a whole lot more money, be more difficult to win those races. Also, Democrats have three seats that are clearly Republican seats. David Hoyle's seat, you already mentioned, John Snow over in the mountains, and a senator named Goss from John Garwood's old seat. I think it's Wilkes County. These are seats that are clearly vulnerable. Everybody knows it, but Republicans are going to have to once again recruit a good candidate. The filing deadline's at the end of February, so they have plenty of time to do it. But they have to recruit electable candidates, and electability to me means can you raise money?
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see who they put in those races. But those three Democrats on Republican turf are very vulnerable. All Republicans have to do is pick up five, and then they're
even.
Yeah, six, and they take over the Senate. Very, very possible.
Now, John, you've for years been studying this situation, and you always point out that the candidate spends the most money has a remarkable winning percentage. Can the Republicans in these races raise enough money, or can the Democrats raise enough money to keep those seats safe?
Well, the one thing that I see that's new for Republicans, in addition to the Obama situation and, of course, the corruption scandal-related stories that could break throughout the year related to Easley and Tony Rand and others, the other thing that's really unique this year is that the head of the party, Tom Fetzer, is the first truly seasoned political professional, seasoned candidate, seasoned city administrator leading the party. So as mayor of Raleigh, I think he won three times. He was forced to work with Democrats, with people from all ideological stripes. So I think Tom is going to be or has the potential to be a great party leader for the Republicans. You're already seeing Fetzer, along with Representative Stamm and Senator Berger, the minority leaders in the House and Senate, working together as a team. They go all over the state as a team, meeting with Republicans, doing press releases as a team. So unity is another factor, and Tom Fetzer is a big part of that. Plus, he knows how to raise money. So I think for the first time, the leadership at the top, a seasoned political pro who's run elections, won elections, run elections, and raise money in big numbers. I think that really enhances their potential to do what you mentioned in your question, and that's raise a competitive war chest.
Okay, so if you had to decide today, what do you think the Senate count's going to be after the election?
Well, you know, at the very least, it's going to be even, because I think once again things are beginning to improve for Republicans. If Republicans self-destruct, which they have done in the past, if they snatch defeat from the jaws of victory, there's nothing that you can do about that. No. So watch Republicans very carefully. Unity is a big, big deal. If Tom Fetzer and the House and Senate leadership are able to unite Republicans behind the goal of winning campaigns rather than pushing a radical right conservative ideology, then they're going to take over the Senate and maybe even the House. If they get all crossed up against each other with infighting like they have in the past, they're not going to take over either House.
Now, we talked earlier about the voice of the unaffiliated in North Carolina, and they're swing, and they in the primary can choose which primary they want to run, vote for. Do you think the Republicans will figure a way to appeal to those unaffiliated?
You know, that's such an important point, because I said there, you know, there are 20% of the voters in this state. Over a million voters are now registered unaffiliated. So it's such a big deal to recruit unaffiliated voters. But unaffiliated voters are not from the radical right mold. So once again, Republicans have got to do what you saw Republican candidates in Virginia, New Jersey, and again Massachusetts do, and that stick to messages that deal with the priorities of the day, such as jobs and the economy, government growth or government spending, and not get sidetracked with issues from the radical right side of things that are going to turn unaffiliated voters away.
Now, we've spent a lot of time talking about this, the state Senate, because there only has to be five changes there, and it's an even thing. Take away a five will make it even, Stephen, right?
That's right.
Okay, now in the House, what's going to happen over there?
Well, same thing. Exactly the same thing. I mean, you have a very, very capable potential. I mean, there's nothing there but potential. But the potential is good. Once again, if Tom Fetzer is able to unite Republicans, if they can tap into unaffiliated voters, if they can get the Tea Party folks to work with them and get behind their candidates, if they can capture the groundswell of angry voters against the establishment, then they're going to take over both houses. Once again, it's yet to be seen. Who are they going to recruit? Are they going to be able to raise money? Are they going to get all caught up in feuding against each other, moderates versus conservatives? If they do everything right, they're going to take both houses.
And a sweeping change in the way North Carolina is run.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, it's
and then if they do the same thing that Obama did and get caught up in it and think it was all about them rather than an anti-establishment vote, then they're going to get thrown out 2 years later, just like.
Well, it's almost like the only time that candidates or elected officials really pay too much attention to the voters is when they are faced with an election, either during the campaign or when they see something like this happening.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And that's
kind of a shame. Well, I tell you, incumbents sure the voters have their attention right now.
Well, they do, and it's going to be interesting to see how this comes out. Of course, this sets up. 4 years from now, or 3.5 years from now, of course, the governor's seat will be up. And Governor Perdue is, of course, not riding a wave of popularity, but she has a couple more years to recover.
Right. She's getting off to a very, very difficult start, struggling. Her numbers are just terrible. I think they're around 30%, according to public policy polling, popular support. So she's in a whole lot of trouble right now, but once again, it's early. It's 1 year of a 4-year term, and there's potential, great potential, that she can turn things around. But remember, she barely won. That was the closest governor's race in America And she caught that wave of Obama voters, huge turnout of the Obama vote in North Carolina in 2008, at the same time, low turnout for Republicans. And she barely won. If it were not for Obama, Pat McCrory would be governor today. So she came in weak because she was not that strong a candidate. She spent $18 million and barely won. McCrory spent $6 million. So that's a big, big, big factor in her building support over the next 3 years for her candidacy for reelection. She started much weaker than most governors start.
John, we appreciate you being with us. JohnDavisConsulting.com is how you would subscribe to John's publication. We appreciate you being with us. Our program has been produced by Josh Ellis, and we will be back again next week. Another reminder, you can hear a repeat of this broadcast on StateGovernmentRadio.com. So until next week, same time, same station, on behalf of our guest John Davis and Josh Ellis, we bid you a good day.
This has been Carolina Newsmakers. For the entire production team, this is Alan Phillips, inviting you to listen to this program and all of the State Government Radio programs via streaming audio at stategovernmentradio.com.